a mystical book. The mysticism is the core of religion. It is the heart where the purpose of religion gets manifested. Religion is practiced at all different levels, depending on the practitioner. Nothing is worth condemning. Everything has its value. But the center of all that is this mystical search, search for the ultimate truth, search for the self, search for the bliss. And it is here that you will find all religions are united. They are one. The superficial differences are there when it comes to different rituals, different dogmas, with various ways of living, and the political affiliations, and the ethnic part of our life. All that certainly is very different, and it does get connected with religion, and it is not wrong to get it connected with religion, because religion does play a role in that. It is something that is very comprehensive. But when it comes to the central defining purpose of religion, then we have to see that where it all leads to, where it all comes from. And then we see that all religions come from the intrinsic nature of humankind. As human beings, we are not satisfied by bread alone. Of course, the bread signifies our physical necessities. Like we need the food, we need shelter, we need the opportunities to prolifer, and so forth. So this is the basic animal need. Let us see that these are the needs of human animal. But human beings are not satisfied with that alone. You can see that very easily, that even though these things can be provided in abundance, still the human beings are seen dissatisfied. They are searching for something more, something that is very deep in their very nature, and they want to get that. That is, you will find it across all different cultures, all different types of these ethnicities and religious expressions, that we want to know the truth. You can see that from this very fact, that there is so much search for knowledge. All the universities, schools, why do we want us to be educated, our children to be educated? We are not satisfied by ignorant life. We want a life of wisdom, a life of knowledge. And this is why we try to find where is the core of all knowledge. It is here we see that the knowledge that keeps on changing and the knowledge that is unchanging, knowledge that keeps on shifting, empirical knowledge, the knowledge that we get in physical sciences is empirical. Empirical in the sense that it keeps on shifting. What we used to think as the the truths of nature. We have discovered the secrets of nature after some years, some decades. Some new truths get discovered, saying that no, that earlier truths were not sufficient, this is the new real truth now we have discovered, and that has been going on since thousands of years. It is an interesting book one should read, The History of Science, written by Bell, an eminent scientist, that how the science progressed. And the progress means what? Progress is a very nice word. But of course it has this idea that we keep on changing our knowledge on the basis of what we have learned earlier. In that sense it is progress. But at the same time, does it not tell us that insufficiency of what we had learned earlier, and therefore also the insufficiency of what we know now? That is why Albert Einstein remarked that the maximum glory that a scientific theory can achieve is to be able to remain as a special case in a theory that is developed sometime later. So it is so that, you know, it is not completely negated, but well, it was true in some sense. There are, if it comes sometimes, we can maybe discuss in some summer the rise and fall of various scientific theories. It is an interesting topic to study, that how many ideas came up and they were believed to be the ultimate truths of all this universal existence, and then they met their doom by the knowledge that came later on. It is, so that knowledge is one thing, the knowledge of the changing, the knowledge of the rising and falling waves. That is one type of knowledge. You all know that those who were having some cholesterol problem earlier, when I arrived in 2001, and even before that in India, I was told, hey, those who have high cholesterol, and I am on the higher side, so they should not eat coconut. Coconut is very bad for them. The things before, you know, a few years passed, just changed. No, coconut is good for you. So now what is, both are scientific, you know. So, but what is truly scientific, who knows? Again, after some years, it will be published. No, coconut is really bad. Are we going to switch it again? So it is. Nothing to condemn it, but the limitations of this kind of knowledge are to be kept in mind. That it is, after all, a knowledge, say, of measuring the height of a wave. You try to measure the height of a wave, while you are measuring, it is changing, you see. And so, because this world, this whole phenomena, including the laws that govern it, so-called laws, they also keep on shifting and changing, and therefore that knowledge is one type of knowledge. But there is the knowledge of the underlying unity, the knowledge of the self, the knowledge of that which does not change. So that knowledge, search for that truth, is at the core of all religions. Who am I? What is this world about? What is our relationships? We want to know that. Even Socrates ultimately declared, know thyself. That is, the ultimate core of all knowledge. When you know self, you know everything. One of the Upanishads, Mundak Upanishad, gradually leads a person to that truth. That Upanishad begins with a question, that knowing what, everything becomes known. And we have this urge in us to know everything. I want to know each and everything. And that is why we are curious about how things happen. It is, we want to know everything. But soon we realize that knowing everything as such is not possible. Because to know one thing, you have to give up the knowledge of other things. I want to become a doctor, a medical specialist. So I have to give up the study of many other branches. I have to give up the study of economics, of geography, of other things, you know, study of arts and so forth. So, because I want to become a doctor. Then again, the focus I have, which doctor, you know, there are so many fields that open up. That, well, do you want to do this? Do you want to study heart? Do you want to study brain? Do you want to study you want to become an orthopedician? What do you want to study? Each field is separate. And even if you choose one field, then there is further specialization. That is why somebody said a very nice thing, that this kind of knowledge means to know more and more about less and less. So this kind of knowledge, therefore, cannot satisfy our desire to know everything. And therefore that question came to this great man's mind. That what is that knowing which everything becomes known? And he goes to the sage asking this question, that knowing which everything becomes known, kasminnu bhagavo vijnate sarvamidam vijnatam bhavati iti. And then gradually that sage leads him to that answer, that know thyself. Tameva ekam janatha atmanam anyavacho vimunchatha. He not only in this verse that thou know this self alone, everything else is just giving different names to different varieties of ignorance, and therefore do not get caught in it. Anya vacho vimunchatha. Everything else is just nomenclature. When I heard this, I pondered over it, what I was valuing at that time. I was student of science then. And then, how is it so? All that I am studying is giving different names to phenomena. I keep on dividing and give a different name, and then I call that knowledge. That is a changing thing is. But when you know this self, you get the true knowledge, and you become liberated also. That is how you know the truth, as Jesus mentions, know the truth and the truth shall liberate you. That you know the truth about this, know the ultimate truth, and thus you will become free. That is another urge of mankind. And that again is the source of religion. Just as the seeking the ultimate knowledge is the source of religion, seeking freedom is also the source of religion. Also seeking happiness is another way that one can understand the origin of religion. We want to be happy. And nobody wants suffering, you see. And we want to be happy. And our search in happiness gets caught in contradiction. Therefore, as I was discussing this morning, I had a lecture on this Hindu ideals at Bridgewater State University. And there, this I was mentioning, look at the, in the American constitutions we have been given, told that these unalienable rights, we have the right to liberty. Right to liberty. What else?
Life.
Right to life. Right to liberty. And not right to happiness. But that is, isn't it significant that those, that Thomas Jefferson, who is credited with writing this Declaration of Independence, he doesn't say the right to happiness. Because everybody has the experience, we do not have right to to happiness, but only pursuit of happiness. My goodness, just see, we keep on pursuing that all the time without getting. Isn't it? We see that the happiness is right there. Start chasing after it. It is... only fortunate few realize that it is chasing to catch the horizon. How long do we have to chase? See, a little child feels that I am in under the thumb of my parents right now. I was talking to a teenage girl some time back. I was staying with them in Alaska. So, and she said, well, you know, I don't have any autonomy now. I have to go by what my parents tell me to do. So, but she is thinking, well, I will go to college and then I will have autonomy. I will then do everything and I will be floating in the ocean of happiness. Then I will be free. We know those years also come and go. People think when I will become, you know, I will complete my bachelor's and then I will find a good job. When I will then minting money and then everything will be very nice. I will find some partner in life, some spouse, somebody. And then, you know, there will be no dearth of happiness in life. Comes and goes. Happiness keeps on eluding. This is a funny contradiction in our pursuit of happiness. We see it there, but when we catch it, we get the thing that we were looking for. I mean, objectively, that is, I want to be a millionaire. Okay, you become a millionaire. I want to be the president. Okay, you become president. Are you becoming happy? You know, now I don't have to comment much. So, it is not a fun, I mean. It is the whole life goes like that. Where is this happiness? Religion is promising us the true happiness by reverting the search. Instead of running after something outside, where you will be keep on running and never reaching. It is never reaching, only running. It is to make a bull run in the oil mill. I have seen this myself. Many might not have here in United States. You don't find it. Now in India also you don't find it. But in my childhood I saw the oil mill was being, powered by bull power. The bull used to rotate it. And then how the bull is to be made to go forward on it. There should be some incentive for the bull to go ahead. So those wise farmers, the mill owners, they would tie on the head of the bull a stick, and then some grass would be hanging right in front of the bull there. The bull would think just 1 foot ahead, and then that is there for me. The bull would keep on going. The oil will be coming out. That's all. The bull will never get that grass. So our pursuit of happiness is very, very similar, friends. But then where is real happiness? The religion, all these mystics, they tell us that go deep within. There is, all of us have one very important thing in our knowledge, very common, but that is forgotten. In the din and turmoil, you know what remains constant? That awareness of I am. I am. When one tries to give a shape to it, everything becomes then unclear, hazy. Because I am this. And immediately I see I am not this, I am that. And it changes. But this awareness, I am, remains. And what is this I? And that is the, therefore the central search in mystics of all times, in all different places. They come from, say, a Hindu background, or a Christian background, or Islamic background, a Taoist background, but you will see, it is, they all speak the same tone. They all say they ultimately the same thing. And many of them, they take up the form of poetry to express themselves. This year I have taken up this great, very popular book in the, not necessarily in the theological circles. In fact, it is not even recognized by the established theology as a book of religion. Not at all. It is a book considered of romantic poetry. Like the books of many Sufi saints, like Hafiz, or Umar Khayyam. They express that intense feeling for God using the human romantic ideas. Also, we see that same in the Hindu lore of that Bhagavatam stories, Radha and Krishna and so forth. This is a way adopted by poets. Poet, you know, is not going by this so-called path of logic. Not that the poet is irrational per se, but the poet sees the limitations of rationality. Our rational side certainly has its value, its utility, but our rational side is not everything. It is, there is the poetic side where we tread on a territory that is not accessible to our rational mind. The storytellers, the poets, therefore, take recourse to that. You will find it like Alice in Wonderland. Now, things, if you try to see rationally, they are not really having it. It cannot be read as a book of science, you see. It is not also a book giving you facts. It is not that. It is the book of, you know, imagination, poetry, that is a very important side of human beings. The imagination that transcends reason. It is, and there you can see the finer truths that are hidden. I can tell you a very common example, a very common illustration that is known by these days. You hardly find anybody who has not read Harry Potter. I am one of those few who has not read, but even I have read some excerpts. So the children were talking about this book, and then I got an idea from them about this, that they were talking that Harry Potter had to catch a train at platform 9 3/4. Platform 9 3/4, what is it? This is, if you see, it is a very artistic idea that our rationality cannot grasp. Rationally, you cannot have a platform 9 3/4, you see. You can have platform 9 and platform 10. That is what Harry Potter initially was told by that officer on the station, that when he asked where is platform 9 3/4, well, what is this? It is platform 9 or platform 10. 9 3/4 we do not recognize at all. That is how human brain actually functions. All our rationality, I don't want to go much deep into it, but that is how it functions. Our brain arranges things in an order. 1, 2, 3, like that. And that is where in between everything is lost. That intellect is a net. And whatever sticks to the threads of the net, only that much we get. Everything else just goes down. And it is therefore the job of poetry and art to try to capture and bring forth to us. So the spiritual awareness, although intellect can and does help us to grasp some part of it, mostly in a negative manner, negative in the sense that all that we understand by our rationality is very limited, is very distorted, and that much the intellect can tell us. But then what it is, that intellect cannot tell us. For that, the art, the poetry, that becomes a help. Meditation becomes a great tool for that, where we transcend the limitations of reason and also of art. But when it comes to expression, these two things are different, you see. Realization and expressing that realization. When it is to be expressed, many teachers who are capable of handling that medium have used the tools of poetry. The Upanishads, for example, are great poetry. Bhagavad Gita, great poetry. They have used poetry to express these wonderful ideas. And this, I have taken this book of Khalil Gibran because it is thought that all those things used to be, you know, in the ancient times. Now in the modern times, nobody can see God. Nobody can have these spiritual ideas. Now it is the world of material development and what is called is that correctly a rat race of chasing all these pieces of material strewn around, compete for that, quarrel for that, and spend our time and the time of others in that meaningless pursuit. So, therefore, although people think like that, it is yet the truth is that even in these modern times, there are people who give their deepest thought, their deepest meditations to try to experience this truth and express their experience. So, this Khalil Gibran's book, Prophet, the Prophet, is very important from that standpoint. This computer has stopped working. Can you change the settings so that it will not shut down? To conserve the power, it goes into sleeping mode from time to time, and so we have to shake it out of its sleep. So, but there is a setting that you can use to change that, so that it will not go to sleep. It also naturally, you know, a boring lecture like this, people also go to sleep. So this computer, poor thing, you see, it also feels like sleeping. So, this book has been immensely popular book, because of its a very beautiful style of expression, the artistic way, because art appeals to us, you know. Khalil Gibran was born, his name actually was Khalil, K-H-A-L-I-L, but on the book you will find it K-A, Khalil. K-A-H-L-I-L. That was a spelling mistake when he was put to school in Boston. When he came from Lebanon and put to school in Boston, and when his name was being written in the school register, and then it was written Khalil. That happens, you know, with immigration and all that. There is a nice story about one Chinese-looking man. Somebody asked him, "What's your name?" He told his name is Johansson. "Oh, you look Chinese, and how do you get this name? Kind of Scandinavian name. How did you get this name, Johansson?" He said, "My name actually is Sam Ting. But what happened at that Ellis Island when I was coming, then they were those days not computers and all that, and not so many immigration rules either. So anybody would just tell the name, this, that, and would be allowed to get in. So ahead of him was one Johansson. So his name was registered and all that, and then the clerk asked him, he said Sam Ting. He heard same thing, so wrote the same name, you see. So, from what happened with Khalil, I don't know, but it became later on Khalil, as far as the book is concerned. He was born in Lebanon. And there is this right click. Okay, there it goes. It is Bashari in Lebanon was the name of the town that he came from originally, and they show also the picture of that house where he was born. So, born on January 6, 1883. Then his father, they were a very not well-to-do family. Somehow they were making the ends meet. The father got into some problems, political problems, and then was imprisoned, and so the mother with Khalil and his one brother and sister, two sisters, decided to migrate to United States, where her brother had moved. And although his father got cleared of all those problems, yet the mother did not budge from her resolve to come here, and they came to Boston. And then at Boston, that was in 1902 that he got into a school there. And he started his formal education, but then the mother did not want him to be just getting educated in American Western culture, and so she sent him to Lebanon again for some years. There he became a wonderful poet in Arabic, although he had learned to write, read in the English poetry also. After spending 6 years, he came back to US and started studying especially the art, and he became a very well-known painter those days. His paintings, drawings started adoring the many newly published books covers. Exhibitions of his paintings were being arranged. He took special training in Paris on this visual art and painting. He belonged to that classicist school, Romanticism and Surrealism. He was, it is said that he was very much influenced by William Blake, his poetry as well as art. So, and then he came back to US as an artist, as a writer, and there was this, when he was writing, one lady, Mary Haskell, she became his patron. She supported him financially. She was headmistress, a Boston school headmistress. And she lent a lot of confidence to him and supported him. There is, the record says that they did not marry. Nor how they intimate they became, how much intimate, that is not known either. But she was his supporter. She was much older to him, but she supported him throughout his life. He lived comparatively a very short life, as you must have read in the earlier slide. He passed away in 1931 at the age of 48. And this poem, you know, this of his, was first published in 1923. And before publication, he mentions that he conceived of this idea of writing this way back in 1912. imagine, you know, for on this small work, he was working and working and working. On the flap of this book, it is said that he mentions Khalil that that it the prophet, since I first conceived the book back in Mount Lebanon, it seems to have been a part of me. I kept the manuscript for years before I delivered it over to my publisher, because I wanted to be very sure. See this repetition. The repetition is for emphasis. The repetition sometimes is boring, you know, when it doesn't add to content. But in such cases, the repetition emphasizes, because we use this word otherwise very glibly, to be sure and so forth. He emphasizes it, to be very sure that every word of it was the very best I had to offer. So this is the story about this book in brief. It is, as we will start studying this book, we will see the tremendous wealth of this. I had not read this book till fairly recently, although I had read some excerpts from it, and I had read Khalil Gibran's some other works a little bit, I had not read this book fully. But one of our devotees, a volunteer, many of you know her, Karan Perry, some discussion about Khalil Gibran was going on, and she said, "Swami, you must read this book." And she brought this book for me from her collection. "You must read it." And then it remained. I was busy with other things, many other studies and all that. So I did not pay much attention to that book. Afterwards, when I started reading it, it opened up a great treasure for me. Deeply these ideas have been presented in very informal language. It does not follow the standard paradigms of a spiritual or religious treatise at all. It is, and yet the message is powerful and clear. The message is very clear, very powerful. And friends, it is very jolting. Let us be prepared, you know, to get jolts. Our ideas will receive a jolt. Why? Because, you know, that is a way of bringing us to truth. When we are steeped in our ideas, that ignorant ideas, steeped in ignorance, then when we have to be brought into wisdom, what is to be done, you know? One has to be shaken out of this ignorance. That is thus needed to be done. It is whenever our notions, if they are deep-rooted, are to be changed, we receive tremors. Because we have been holding on to them for quite some time, maybe for generations. And being just caught in them, we refuse to see the truth. So it is like a person who is in dark for a long time, is taken to some lighted place, cannot, you know, see anything, gets dazzled by the brightness, but the eyes gradually get adjusted to it and then start seeing, marvels, wow, what a nice, now I can see. So similarly, coming to this light is an experience. So this book brings us this idea. It is, this begins with a story, an imaginary thing. As I mentioned, these things are imaginary, but imaginary does not mean false. What this world around us is, it is just generated by our imagination. Just because we get used to certain imagination doesn't mean that it becomes true. It is in dream, we are very much rooted in that dream. We feel that it is all real. Is it so? Is it real? While we are in dream, it is real. It is only when we wake up and compare, then we see that it is not real. So, imaginary should not be associated with being untrue. It is as true as anything that we see around here. Only imagination makes us break the bondage of this so-called facts. It is. Therefore, this story begins. It has great resemblance with the idea of God incarnation. God incarnation, of course, in various ways is in many different religions, especially as he was growing, Khalil Gibran, he was born as a Catholic, that Eastern branch of Catholics. It is he was growing with that, but never was confined by that. So he received those ideas. It is said that he also received this ideas from various Sufi saints. It is, we will look at it next time in our class, that he was very close to Baha'i sect. His vision is from that. We have, so in Hindus, the special feature of this idea of God incarnating as man is not, is that it is not limited to incarnating only once for all. That is the one and probably the only notable difference. For Hindus, the God takes, assumes human form from time to time to teach humanity. You can see here that humanity can be taught by human beings. We basically learn from human beings. Therefore, in our schools, you see, you have human beings as teacher. Have you seen Dylan amongst your professors? Was there any cow or cat? No. They were all human beings are appointed as teachers because we learn from human beings. And therefore, these great spiritual truths also are to be taught by human beings. But that being has to be, you know, knowledgeable about it, has to be fully knowing this truth. So therefore has to be one with the divine. So on the one hand, that person is human. On the other hand, that person is divine. So it is like that is called God incarnating. And as it is very famously described in Bhagavad Gita, that wherever there is the decline of religion and then ascendancy of the material pursuits, God incarnates as man to teach humanity that how their life can become meaningful, happy and perfect. So, but many understand that God incarnated just once and that's it. So, no further incarnation. So, in fact, I remember that incident very vividly. The pastor of an evangelical church here in Massachusetts. So we used to meet, a very nice man, very service oriented, charitable, wonderful speaker. So we became friends at our interfaith forum, and then one day he asked me, he had come here and he asked me that what is my view of Jesus. I said, well, I consider him as God incarnate. And then he pointed to Sri Ramakrishna. Then what is this? Then I replied to him that, look, you know, now you came to me with this orange shirt. The other day I saw you were wearing a blue shirt. Now, because you changed the shirt, should I not recognize you? After all, the body is like a garb, a clothing. It is not you per se. So the same divine who took the garb of Jesus, suitable for that time, that age, has taken now the garb of Sri Ramakrishna. What is difficult to understand? It is, do you accept that Jesus is not merely the body? And he became thoughtful and said, well, was not, because as I mentioned, the deep-rooted ideas are difficult to give up. So he was not ready to immediately accept. He said, oh, well, that is a point to be pondered over. I have to think about it. So, but although he never verbalized, he started coming here more often, very lovingly. He interacted with all of us here, whosoever was here. So it was very nice. So what I mean is, this is the only difference between that idea of God incarnating as a human being. So in the Christian and Islamic background, it is called the Prophet. And it is connected to the divine realm at one end and like us at the other end. Now that God as human beings has come amongst us, now as human being there is coming and there is going also. Now in human time, that messenger has spent 12 years. It is, as the story goes, as he wrote, Al-Mustafa, the chosen one. And that is the meaning of this word, Al-Mustafa. Mustafa is means the one who gives up his rights for the joy or the good of others. He is one who is to be sacrificed, like a ram, a chosen ram that is put to sacrifice. So that is the word Mustafa, that ready to sacrifice. So he, Al-Mustafa, the chosen and the beloved, who was a dawn unto his own day. See the words, you know, you just keep on marveling at the charm of these words. Who was the dawn unto his own day. It is, he didn't need, what it means is self-effulgence. It is not that he was illumined by some sunlight. It is, we are dependent on the borrowed light. Here is the dawn unto himself. Didn't need to be taught by some human beings as such. Dawned unto oneself. He was dawn unto his own day. Had waited 12 years in the city of Orphelis, an imaginary city, for his ship that was to return and bear him back to the isle of his birth. So that is how this book begins. We shall start reading more about it from next Tuesday. Today's time is over. But I am sure, at least for me, it will be a very fascinating study. And thank you, friends, for joining in this search for our deeper truth, taking help of this wonderful treatise. So we shall just conclude with the prayers of peace. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harih Om Tatsat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. One announcement, friends. A couple of programs. One, of course, has already been announced in our flyers.